This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Oklahoma Perspective. Oklahomans will be voting for a new state auditor this year. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills sat down with Gary Jones and candidate for state auditor Cindy Bird and asked them to explain exactly what a state auditor does.
We are here with Gary Jones, who is the current state auditor, ran for governor, had a good run, didn't quite get into that runoff, but going to be stepping aside.
Well, we changed the debate.
You absolutely did.
We changed the debate.
And we'll get into that a little bit.
Yeah, and so and I'm term limited, so I...
So you really didn't have the choice. It was run for something or go.
You know, I have alternatives. I could have gone home and spent time with my cows and my family. But I've always said I got involved in government to leave it better than I found it. And that's what my mission is. And that's why I'm here today.
Also with this, Cindy Bird, who has been with the state auditor's office for, was it 21 years?
21 years, Russell.
And is currently...
Deputy state auditor over local governments.
And you have... obviously decided to throw your hat in the ring to take the top job at the state auditor's office. I'm going to start with you for a second. Can you explain to people what the heck the state auditor does? Because, you know, other than, I don't know, balance the checkbook, I'm not sure people really have a clear concept of the office.
Russell, we're the office that's out here working for the taxpayer. We're the ones out here looking every day to make sure your tax dollars are spent correctly. And we're also the ones who will answer the phone for any taxpayer who has a problem or an issue that they want explained in their community. We are auditing your local governments, your state agencies, and we are helping government be more accountable to the taxpayers.
And that includes the counties?
County governments, district attorneys, emergency medical service districts, all of your state agencies, and some political subdivisions.
So, Gary, I got to ask you, during the governor's race, I constantly heard, well, you know, we just need to audit every agency. We need to audit every agency. And I'm like, we have a state auditor's office. Have they been doing that? What are the kind of
and we've seen our appropriations cut by 40% since I've been there. We've gone from $5 million a year in appropriations to three, but we're actually doing more audits than we've ever done. And while we do believe there's a need for more performance audits, we've been pushing for the entire 7.5 years I've been there to have the authority and the resources to do those. So, you know, yes, we need to audit everything, but virtually everything has already been audited. And there's also additional audits that need to be done. And we've been standing willing and able to do those, just don't have the authority to initiate those.
And is that authority come from the legislature, the governor, both? How does that work?
We've had like five different bills we try to get passed, and they would make it through the House and they get killed in the Senate. We had one bill that was a great bill that created a joint committee on accountability, which would have been a committee made up of senators and representatives, Democrats and Republicans, working with the auditor's office to go through and provide that great oversight. The problem is once it finally got out of the Senate, once the senator that held it up for so many years finally released it, the governor vetoed it. And so, you know, that we believe that bill ought to be passed again. You know, we have a tremendously professional staff working at the auditor's office, and we can do them more cost effectively and efficiently. And that's what needs to be done. There needs to be a coordinated effort to work with the people's watchdog, which is the elected auditor, in order to go do these. And what happens is you get too much politics involved.
And it was Governor Fallon that vetoed?
Governor Fallon vetoed the bill.
Did she in any way explain her decision?
Well, at that time, she had set up performance teams under the Office of Management and Enterprise Services, and she said it was a duplication of efforts. I believe it's a duplication of efforts. However, it's a violation of the Constitution, of that constitutional authority of the auditor's office that got circumvented. So what they should have done is, and finally they have, they've done away with those performance teams in the Office of Management and Enterprise Services. However, they have not authorized the state auditor's office to do the performance audits that need to be done.
Okay, so she basically said no to this panel that would have been, you said, both senators and House members,
right?
Both parties. She said no to that because I've already got the OMES working on that.
Right, and now they've done away with the OMES.
Done away with the OMES.
And they had funded them approximately $2 million, And we have never seen a report that they've done. So that's what needs to happen is the constitutional. And keep in mind, the auditor's office is the state auditor and the inspector generals. That's why we say auditor and inspector. It used to be two constitutional offices, the state auditor and the inspector general. They got combined, but they've limited the authority of the auditor's office to go in and do the inspections to the level that an inspector general ought to be able to do.
So it sounds like the watchdog is on a kind of a short leash.
Absolutely.
Maybe a little bit.
Right.
All right, so Cindy, my understanding is you've got a lot of experience, for instance, going into county governments and uncovering fraud, corruption. Kind of explain a little bit about how that worked. What were you doing?
Well, just in the last 3 years, my audits have resulted in more than $10 million being exposed in fraud and waste, and six elected officials being removed from office through either indictments, charges filed, or forced resignations. So the auditor's office is out here actively looking for fraud as we're doing these audits. One of the things, whenever Gary Jones came in, he appointed me as the director over local government audits. And as he mentioned that our resources were cut about 40%, we had to figure out how to do audits more efficiently. So we really got into data analytics and analyzing the information in the databases, finding out where things weren't bid properly, finding out where things weren't used efficiently, and also ran into some fraud. So that is something that I think taxpayers are demanding today. They want more accountability for the money that they're paying. They want to know where their money's going, and they want to make sure it's not being misused.
You know, again, referring back to our gubernatorial candidates, the words fraud, corruption, and waste, you know, of course, I guess a lot of politicians are, you know, they're going to sound these emotionally charged words, and we're going to clean the house. Is it really that much? I mean, is it really like billions of dollars worth of fraud, waste, and corruption at state government level, in your opinion?
I don't think it's billions of dollars. Now, we can always be a little more frugal. We can try to eliminate some of the waste. But keep in mind that state agencies have been cut. The resources have been cut, but we still need to make sure that the money's getting where it's supposed to go.
So, and when things get cut, you got to be more efficient.
Well, we are. And in our office, when I first came in, we had a chief of staff, a public relations person. We had nine legislative or administrative assistants. We've done away with all those positions. We've turned them into auditors. We've gone from like 120-something employees down to 109. But we're getting more work done with less. In fact, we're one of the most cost-effective, efficient agencies. Cindy is every day is looking for ways to save money. We're looking at how can we combine functions without hurting our mission. You know, 3 years ago, Governor Fallon said we should eliminate 10% of all the non-mission critical expenses. I said, no, we shouldn't. We should focus on eliminating 100% of all the non-mission critical expenses. If it's not critical to the mission, then we shouldn't be doing. That's what we've done in our office. We are the epitome of efficiency in government. And so that's what we focus on. And when, like Cindy talked about, when we came in and we've done things to make it to where the accounting systems within the counties are done in such a way that we can go through and run those programs from one county to the next, and we can find things that stick out. And then once you find those irregularities, then you start looking at those and saying, well, why is this number so high here on transportation or some other area? And then you go back and look and realize that there's the reason there's an anomaly there is the fact that somebody's doing something they shouldn't be doing. And that's a great way to find those things. And it's extremely important that you have professionals that know what they're doing. I said, we've never had a political hire since I've been in office. And one of the things we do is Cindy and her team go through and they review the applications for employees, and then they make recommendations based on who the best person is for the job every single time. We hire people that have accounting degrees, that have at least 10 years experience in accounting. And so when you get capable, competent people, you know, one time I can remember I had hired a guy that had been the deputy auditor for 25 years. I've been deputy auditor for 5 years, been with the office 25 years. And he said when he went to work for the office, he walked in, there's people everywhere. And he asked the guy, I said, how many people work here? And the guy looked at him and said, about half. Well, and because it was such a political, you know, there are so many political hires, we don't do that. We hire capable, competent people. And so we put those people in place. And we have one of the top audit shops in the country because we have, you know, and what happens too is once we get these people in here, then after they get 3 or 4 years experience, they all of a sudden go to work other agencies because they're getting paid a lot more money because they have the education. When they come in, they get the training. And so, you know, we have kind of a revolving door of employees, but we make sure that every time we hire somebody back, that it is a capable, competent person.
So Cindy, I'm curious. He spoke earlier about leaving it better than you found it. How would you go about doing that? What would be your goal? What needs to improve? What needs to get better at the state auditor's office?
Well, Russell, one thing that I would like to point out is that current state auditor Gary Jones has done a lot in the 7.5 years that he's been the state auditor, and it should be the mission of every new state auditor to build on that, on what the last one has left behind. There's still a lot of work to be done. And one of the things that I would probably focus on first is doing a lot more operational audits on state agencies. We need the resources to do those. And that is a very useful type of audit. I just did an operational audit on the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office last year that resulted in exposing $750,000 of waste and abuse. It was a very good audit that the board was able to use to make better financial decisions and get that county back on track. Those are the same types of audits that we could do with state agencies and really give taxpayers a good accounting of where their money is going. We just need more resources to get that done.
Can you explain to folks what you mean by operational audit? Because, I mean, to us non-math, non-financial people, audit is kind of a vague word. It means it comes from to listen, right, or to hear. But I'm going with audio there, the Latin root, but audit, what's that mean? Okay, well, that means going through the books and trying to find any, you know, funky math or whatever. But so sort of explain what an operational audit is.
Well, there are different types of audits. One of the things that should be noted, whenever people hear that something's been audited, they assume that everything's been looked at and, you know, there's no waste, inefficiencies.
Well, there was an audit. Everything's great.
But that's not the case. A financial statement audit, for instance, is an audit that is, the focus is to ensure that the financial statements are presented accurately, free of material misstatement. And that's the type of audit that we do on the state of Oklahoma. That's the comprehensive annual financial report that we audit. That's very important for us to ensure Oklahoma continues to receive the federal funding as well as our bond rating. So that audit is only going to look at numbers with some compliance issues. A performance audit, which State Auditor Gary Jones has pushed for quite some time, that's an audit that's going to go in and really measure the performance to make sure you're meeting the goals of the agency or the entity, to make sure you're using every available resource to the most efficient manner. An operational audit is a different type of audit that, obviously, a performance audit is what we would want on every state agency, but without the proper authority, the state auditor's office can't just go in and do that. We can, however, go in and perform operational audits. And a well-designed operational audit can still look for any kind of misuse or mismanagement. And that's something that we need to get going.
It's kind of a combination of looking at the financial. What you're looking for in the financial statement audit is, was the expenditure properly recorded? You know, a good example is I mentioned, you know, a financial statement audit won't come back and say, well, you didn't need a chief of staff. What it'll do is say, well, was that person paid properly? Was everything, all the accounting done properly? But when you come back with a performance, you go, well, hold it, you don't need these people. You can take that money and use it better elsewhere. One thing Cindy didn't mention on the audit that was done in Cleveland County was that as soon as we started that audit, the sheriff sued the county commissioners, wanting additional money to run his operation. After the audit came back, they dropped the lawsuit, and the sheriff resigned because she showed that the money was there if used properly to run the operation, run the jail, and they did not need this additional money that the sheriff was suing for. And so what happened there was they were facing a very expensive lawsuit, but because it was an operation audit, you could look and see, well, you're spending this money here, and even though it's recorded correctly, it's not being spent in a manner that's in the best use of the citizens. And so, and there's some things that were done that actually borderlined illegal, but that got exposed because of the operation audit. Because you can go through and design the procedures that you're looking at to look to see whether or not only is it recorded correctly, but is the expenditure done in such a manner that's the best use of the taxpayer's dollar?
So what I'm kind of hearing is, you know, a financial audit is, you know, can we show this many dollars came in, this many dollars went out, and it balanced? Yay.
And was it spent legally?
And legally. Okay. And then the operational budget adds context. Okay. Well, what was it spent on, and how was it spent, and was it spent in a manner that's proper and legal? And
Was it spent in a manner is the best use of those dollars? You know, for instance, like I said, we came in and we would, in a financial statement audit, you look at transportation. And we have a high transportation cost because we have all these auditors working across the state. But what we do is we go through and we do these reviews and basically do our own kind of operation audits to determine whether or not, for instance, furnishing that employee a car to drive in their business, you know, they're doing state business, is more efficient, or is it more efficient to furnish them mileage? Because maybe they drive less mileage, so we make a determination as to whether or not what's the best use. Is it, and we do it in a manner that what is the best use of taxpayers' dollars? Where before they just first they paid everybody mileage, and then they determined later that, hold it, we could probably save money if we furnished them cars. So then they furnished everybody a car. Then we came back and said, okay, let's look to see in which case is it the best use of taxpayers' dollars.
So it doesn't have to be all or nothing.
Maybe it doesn't have to be all or nothing. So subsequently, what we have is we now have we've brought the cost of transportation down hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and then that money in turn can go toward more auditors to get more work done.
All right, so we're going really long here, but this is interesting stuff for me. And this last couple of years in Oklahoma has been like crazy. Of course, we had the oil, you know, price of oil drops, big bust. The state relies very heavily on, you know, the taxes and fees from natural gas and oil production, and it hurt. And as you mentioned, every agency in the state took budget cuts. Your cut was what, 40%?
40%
per agency. So you know what I'm talking about. So what impacts, other than helping with efficiency and helping to make sure that the money's getting spent legally, what impact does the state auditor's office have on, you know, the decisions that on how that budget gets made? Or does it, or are you just sort of powerless to do anything about that?
The state auditor's office is not invited to the table to create the budget. One of the things that we could do that would have impact is write good reports like we are doing to let legislators know how that money is being spent and where they can find efficiencies.
Should the state auditors, I mean, these are the people who are understand finance, understand the money, or can add and subtract way better than I can. So, you know, do you think they should have a voice, a seat at that table?
We're doing the budget is actually an accounting function, and you can't do the accounting and do the auditing, which means you can't grade your own test. But what we can, like Cindy mentioned, is a good example is we did an audit on an agency that was their mission was to provide a trade show for the oil and gas industry. And they were spending $750,000 a year. Our audit came back and said that, you know, you need to seriously consider whether or not this should be merged with another agency or whether it even needs to be a function of state government. They're now spending $250,000 instead of $750,000. That audit cost $10,000. They're saving $500,000 a year just because there is results of that audit. And there's things like that. If we can show them how government can run more cost effectively and efficiently, then there's more dollars to provide to core services. But we're the ones that go and we are the independent group. And then people said, well, we need independent auditors. We are independent because of the fact that we're elected by the people. We don't report to the governor. We don't report to the legislature. We work for the citizens of Oklahoma. And that's one thing Cindy has done a great job of. She has a very good understanding of who she works for. And that's why it's important that we have somebody that knows what the mission of the auditor's office is and doesn't want to get into running state government, because they're not the ones that run state government. They're the watchdog that provides that oversight for state government.
All right. So, you know, it's your job interview for the people are hiring, you know, because Gary's leaving. He has no choice. He's term limited. So let's wrap up by giving you a chance to, you know, make your pitch. What is it that you want the folks to hear?
First of all, I want people to know I care about where their money's being spent. And whenever it's wasted or abused, I'm just as outraged as they are. I think that there is an outcry for outsiders right now in every race, but that is not the case with the state auditor's office. The state auditor's office is where you want experience. You want someone who knows what the law says and that can hold everyone spending your tax dollars accountable to those laws. I would say that I have 21 years of experience in this office. I know how to make a difference. I have a track record that is available on our website, which is sai.ok.gov.
Gary Jones and candidate for state auditor Cindy Byrd. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interview. This is Oklahoma Perspective. For Cox Media Group, I'm Bert Williams. This is Oklahoma Perspective. After State Question 788 passed, there has been some confusion about the rules and regulations that will govern the possession of medical marijuana. Currently, marijuana laws in the state of Oklahoma are confusing. Defense Attorney Jay Ramey recently talked to KRMG's Russell Mills about the state's marijuana laws and how the new laws governing medical marijuana might change or complicate them.
Kind of explain to us, maybe go into a little more detail on exactly how it does work.
Well, the statute that got passed with the passage of 788 says possession of up to 0.5 ounces of marijuana by persons who can state a medical condition, which we're not sure what that means, but not in possession of a state-issued medical marijuana license shall constitute a misdemeanor offense with a fine not to exceed $400. So there's this part about you have to state a medical condition, and I don't know who you're supposed to state that to, whether it's the policeman at the side of the road, whether they're going to hold court at the side of the road when you're pulled over. I don't know. Are you supposed to state this to a judge? And I've heard even the DAs are confused about this. We're not sure exactly. And what does that mean, state a medical condition? I mean, I can state a medical condition. I can say gout. Right. I can say diarrhea. I can say broken arm. Are you supposed to state that that's why you have the marijuana? It's very unclear, and it's not very well written exactly how this is all supposed to work.
Right. And I was sitting here thinking, well, I can state I have anything, but proving it and to a judge's satisfaction might be a little trickier. So right now, what I'm hearing you say is we don't really know what that law means. And of course, the legislature eventually is going to get their hands on it. And then after that, eventually the courts are going to get their hands on it. Meanwhile, we still have the existing statutes on possession in Oklahoma, which are still in force. Can you explain those to us?
Right now, the penalty range for possession of marijuana carries from 0 to 1 year in jail and a fine between $0 and $1,000. Go ahead.
Or both?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
And typically, right now, for a first offense, they want some sort of probation. Usually, you want to get a deferred sentence so you don't have a marijuana conviction. And something else I was wanting to say about this, if you did just get a fine of $400, and if you just paid that, some people don't understand that, well, number one, you're going to have a misdemeanor conviction for marijuana, which there's a lot of collateral consequences from that. One consequence is if you were in your car when you got the citation and they're telling you, well, you can just pay $400, assuming you can state the medical condition, all that, you lose your driver's license for 6 months. You can also lose student financial aid. If you have a misdemeanor conviction for marijuana, you can't get a gun license, and I forget how many years it is. I think it's 5 years. It used to be if you had a marijuana conviction, even a misdemeanor, you couldn't get a gun license at all forever. You were forever barred. They've changed that now, and I think it's 5 years. I may be off on that. You know, there may be some jobs you can't get. There may be some other things. So what people think is $400, they think, oh, well, that's just like paying a traffic citation. I'll just pay it just like a traffic citation. Well, it's not. It's a misdemeanor conviction for the possession of marijuana.
So there are ramifications beyond just, you know, ponying up $400 and going on with your life.
That's correct. And I get these calls all the time from these people that have gone to all these little tiny towns around Tulsa where they tell you, you can plead guilty to the possession of marijuana and just pay this fine. And then weeks later, they get a letter from Department of Public Safety saying your driver's license is suspended. And these people call me up. I had one just call me a couple days ago. And I'm like, yes, that's what happened. That's why you call a lawyer beforehand to ask what the ramifications might be rather than after.
Ounce of prevention, I reckon. And really,
right,
I mean,
exactly.
if you're going to get pulled over and get stopped and get searched and everything, your first line of defense is simply not consent to the search? Am I off base there?
No, that's I'm also kind of known as a know your rights guy, because on my Facebook stuff I like to teach people about knowing their rights. And yes, you should never consent to a search, never make statements to the police, and I've been teaching people that you got the Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment right to remain silent and right to counsel. Don't make any statements to the police. The problem is, this going back to the statute we were talking about on 788, it says you have to state a medical condition. Well, who are you going to state that to? The police officer out at the side of the road when you're supposed to be keeping your mouth shut and waiting to talk to a lawyer about the whole situation. So that's what makes this whole thing confusing, because I always tell people, don't make any statements to the police. Go talk to a lawyer, and then we'll get it sorted out in court.
All right. So realistically, how stringently are the possession? And by the way, we're talking about possession, simple possession here.
Right. Correct.
We're not talking about having an amount that is could be considered, you know, intent to distribute. We're not talking about the paraphernalia and all the other stuff or the tax stamps. I mean, there's a lot of stuff they can right. tag on to the possession charge. So simple possession, how stringently are those laws enforced here? How hardcore are the cops being about it?
Well, I only hear from the people who got arrested, or sometimes they get a citation. That's the only people I hear from. They come in here and they tell me the police were very stringent. Right. Of course, I know there's cases, and because I hear cases once in a while where a police officer catches someone with marijuana and takes the marijuana and sends them on home, you know, or dumps it out on the side of the road, sends them on home. How often that happens, I don't know, because no one comes to my office to tell me about that.
That's fair.
I just hear about it sometimes, but it seems to me the police are very stringent about marijuana, because they always, well, when I first started practicing law about 20 years ago, they would always arrest people for misdemeanor possession, simple possession of marijuana. They would almost always arrest people, even though they had the discretion to issue a citation. Well, nowadays, it seems like they're more willing to issue a citation, although that's maybe 10-15% of my cases where they issue a citation. All the rest of them, they arrest them, take the person down to the jailhouse. If they're in their car, the car gets towed, and they have to go to jail and bond out. So as far as I'm concerned, the police are still pretty stringent. I'm hoping with the passage of 788, they're going to become less stringent, but who knows?
Interesting. So when you read over the language of 788, as an attorney who deals with these kind of cases, were you sort of stumped as to, you know, why there wasn't more specificity built in?
Well, especially this part about, you know, making it a $400 fine if you can state a medical condition. I was saying, why didn't they just say it's a $400 fine instead of putting in this part about the medical condition? Or why not make it more clear, you know, say who can state a medical condition for giving a reason why they need to, you have the marijuana the police officer has caught them with, and then to clarify, who are you supposed to state this to? Are you supposed to state it to a judge? I don't like the idea of stating it to a police officer out there on the street, because then the discretion's all up to him, and you don't have your attorney there to safeguard your rights. You don't have a judge there as a referee. You got you and the police officer, which is a very intimidating situation. And I don't know how that works. And what if the police officer says, well, I don't believe you? I mean, it's very confusing. As an attorney, as someone who's been practicing law for as long as I have, it's very confusing, this one provision in 788.
So now we're looking at a couple of possible constitutional amendments, 796 and 797. Have you read through those? Do you have any thoughts on those yet? Or you just
No, I haven't even read through those yet.
Okay. So, and do you think that the political climate is in Oklahoma is ready for, you know, actual legalization of recreational marijuana? Do you think that's even possible?
Well, I'm ready for it. I've been, because I go to Colorado and I go to California, visit all. I've even been in Amsterdam a couple times. So, but, you know, the Sooner poll came out a couple weeks ago, and I think it said 60-61% would vote no. I think that's probably pretty close to being accurate. What I thought we should have done is let the medical pass, let it get going for a couple of years, let people kind of get used to it and see that marijuana is not as bad and evil as some people think it is. And I thought it would have been better to vote on recreation here in a couple of years. But, you know, if it passes, I mean, I hope it passes. I will certainly vote for it, but I don't know. I have no idea if it will pass or not.
Well, and I frankly would be stunned to see it on a ballot before 2020. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm pretty sure the Attorney General will take a shot at amending the ballot title, which will lead to a court case and a battle, and that'll take time. And I just don't – I mean, I think what will happen is what happened with the state question 788.
Right. And in my opinion, that would be better. I think that would be better to vote on it later than sooner. I mean, anytime you can vote on something later and you can educate more people about why it should be legal, and you get more young people entering the voting rolls. And I hear a lot of people say this, and I hate to say it because it sounds bad, But all the older people that might be against it, well, they'll die, and so they won't be voting.
Presumably.
As terrible as that sounds, I hate to say it. But.
Yeah, that's – I mean, it's harsh, but it's reality.
Right.
And that's sometimes reality is harsh, thus the term. So as a defense attorney, you know, there's been so much talk about criminal justice reform and even some legislation passed raising the amount of value that a theft has to be to qualify as a felony, trying to get more people into treatment for drug possession rather than just sending them to jail. Is it taking hold? Is it taking effect? Are you seeing a real impact of criminal justice reform in your practice?
Well, I don't know about all that, but what I do like and what I have seen is, of course, you used to have people getting caught with a little bit of meth, a little, you know, ecstasy, little. I don't get a lot of cocaine cases for some reason. You get a lot of meth, you don't get very many cocaine. But all these, or just some kid get caught with some pill, some Schedule II pill that maybe his parent left in the car that he had a prescription for, and they're charged with a felony. You know, they were up until a year ago, and now they're all charged with misdemeanors. And I to me, that's a lot more just than charging some kids, an 89-year-old kid with a felony for having a pill or ecstasy or methamphetamine or something like that. So I am glad to see those changes. I guess that law has been in effect a little over a year now, and I'm glad to see it.
Defense Attorney Jay Ramey. Oklahoma's runoff election is scheduled for August 28th. Tulsa County Election Secretary Gwen Freeman talked with Russell Mills about the runoff election and about the registration deadline if you're not registered to vote yet.
No vacations for you in the near future because we have runoff election coming up.
We do.
And we also have city races coming up and city propositions. There's a lot going on August 28th. Kind of run down some of the numbers for me, Gwen.
Okay. It is, like you said, it's going to be a very busy election. 21 Republican runoff races. We have one Libertarian runoff race, and of course that's for governor. 3 Democratic runoff races. In addition to that, we have the Tulsa City Council races. There are 6 of those, and then 6 propositions for the city of Broken Arrow that we'll be voting on.
So the hope is that, well, you know, people will turn out to vote because that's a lot going on. And that's more than we normally see, I would think, on a runoff. And I know you haven't been election board secretary very long and you don't have a long history there. But folks probably are saying, wow, what's the scuttlebutt around the office? Are they saying, wow, we don't usually see this many things on the ballot?
Well, I think even more impressive than the number of things on the ballot is the number of folks that showed up in the June election. We had record turnout numbers for June. Obviously, we had an issue on the ballot that garnered a lot of attention, that being the medical marijuana issue. But we've had an increase in voter registration that's been quite impressive over the last, I'd say, probably 6 months or so. I think people are becoming more politically engaged, and that's always really good news for us.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's driving some of this is the whole situation with the teachers and education in the state of Oklahoma. And a lot of those folks are organizing and getting political. Would you agree?
I do. I actually, when we sit and talk about the issue of why such a renewed spark and interest in politics, we oftentimes refer to the teacher walkout and the legislative session that at times was very, very contentious. As you know, the Tulsa public schools are letting their teachers out to vote for a day to vote in November. So I think that had a great deal to do with it. And we're very, very pleased about that, as a matter of fact.
Well, and they're not the only ones. I think Oklahoma City and several other districts are following suit. And the idea is not just to let the teachers vote, but also 18-year-old students can go out and vote. And some schools, I think, serve as voting precincts, and it's kind of disruptive to be doing both things simultaneously. So I think there's decent reasons for them to do that.
I think it's a wonderful thing. I know that there are other states where they let a lot of folks out for the day to vote, and I look forward to the day when Oklahoma follows suit.
Yeah, having a state holiday on election day would be something that you know might be interesting. Of course, I would still be working. I'm not going to get that day off no matter what. So
nor would I.
Nor would you.
You and I would both be working. And we also are you know really really wanting to get the word out to everyone that about our voter registration deadline. Obviously, we have the August 28th election coming up. But you have to be registered, Russell, before then. In fact, by this Friday, it's the last day to apply for voter registration in order to be eligible to vote in that election coming up. If you send your registration in by mail, it must be postmarked by midnight on Friday. Otherwise, it needs to arrive. You can bring it on down to the election board in person if you like, but it needs to be here by 5 o'clock on Friday, August 3rd, in order to be eligible to vote.
And is there anywhere else I could take that form? Because I can print it out online. I can go to the election board, print off my voter registration form online, fill it out.
Yes.
Is there anywhere I can take it besides the election board?
Nope. Actually, you can pick the applications up. You can pick them up here at the election board and fill one out here. You can pick up your application at most post offices, tag agencies, public libraries, and that sort of thing. And just as you just stated, you can go to www.elections.ok.gov, print out your application. Once it's printed and once you've filled it out, you need to either drop it off in person here at the election board or mail it in.
Okay, and the deadlines again are 5 p.m. in person or postmarked by midnight on Friday if you're mailing it.
That's correct.
All right, cool deal. And let's see, what else? What about the general? What's the deadline for voter registration if you're planning on voting in November? Do you know that off the top of your head?
Registration deadline for the general election on November the 6th is actually October the 12th, 5 p.m. Same rules apply.
Okay. So this is a runoff. Let's say I am an independent voter. I can't. Well, actually, I am an independent voter. We don't even have to hypothesize there. So if I was inclined to go out and vote on August 28th, I can vote in the city elections because those are nonpartisan.
Correct.
So that's everybody gets to vote for the city elections, period.
That's right.
I would presume that's the same for the propositions in Broken Arrow.
Yes, absolutely. If you're registered there, you can certainly vote for the propositions in Broken Arrow. Those two races are nonpartisan, as you mentioned, and anyone can vote on those. If you're an independent and you're not registered with either the Republican, Democrat, or Libertarian Party, you only have one party that will allow you to vote in their primaries this year. Now, a couple of years ago, the Libertarians were allowing independents to vote in their primaries. They've since decided against that. And now the only primary that you're allowed to vote in as an independent is the Democratic primary. Now, remember this. This is super important. When you go to the polls and you're an independent voter and you would like to vote in the Democratic primary, our rules state specifically that you must ask for that ballot. So a lot of voters go in there thinking, well, they're just going to hand me the Democratic ballot. Absolutely not. As an independent, you're allowed to vote any party, obviously, that you want in the general. But in the primary, you have to specifically require and ask our precinct officials for that Democratic ballot.
And there was some confusion on that on June 26th on the part of voters. Correct? I mean,
right. I mean, I think it is a little bit confusing, especially when parties vote one year to allow you to vote in their primary, and then 2 years later, you're not allowed to vote in the primary. So they do change the rules quite frequently. We just have to keep up with them.
So much fun to keep up with how the political parties are handling their own rules. So at this point, the Democrats, let's just go back over this one more time. The only people who are allowed to vote, or the only party that allows independent voters to vote in their primaries, and that includes the primary runoff in Oklahoma, is the Democrats.
That's correct. And then, of course, come November, you can vote for whoever you like. But
yeah,
in this
Katie
particular upcoming election, yes, and it probably will be Katie bar the door.
Tulsa County Election Secretary Gwen Freeman. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interviews. This is Oklahoma Perspective. For Cox Media Group, I'm Bert Williams. This is Oklahoma Perspective. The new Oklahoma teacher pay raise has gone into effect. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to State Superintendent Joy Hoffmeister about the positive effect it will have on Oklahoma teachers and hiring.
Joy Hoffmeister, thank you for being willing to spend a little time with us. Yesterday was the day that statutorily the teacher raises went into effect in the state of Oklahoma. This as a result of a stormy legislative session last year, a gigantic teacher walkout. It's been a big old dust up. But I think you would posit that this does not necessarily solve a whole lot of problems. Can you kind of just tell me where you think we're at right now?
Well, it absolutely. August 1 is a historic day when the landmark legislation for a teacher pay raise, which would be an average of $6,100 for teachers, goes into effect. So all teachers are going to see that raise. Some might even see a much larger raise as they have more experience and advanced degrees. So this is a range. And that is something that absolutely is well deserved. And we know it's essential so that we can, number one, show respect for our education community. And we've got to keep those who have left Oklahoma classrooms to other states or to other industries in order to take care of their own families. Our kids deserve to have a teacher. So this is step one, but this does not immediately reverse a teacher shortage. That is something that occurred over a period of years, and it's going to take some years to get past that.
And so how are we on emergency certifications and all that? That seems like the numbers are still pretty high right now, yes?
They really are, and that is so discouraging. Here's what's happening with that. It's important that folks understand that you can't apply to be emergency certified. What occurs under state law is that when a district has posted for a position and no qualified applicant has come forward for them to hire, then after a period of that posting, they can then recruit someone that they have confidence in to step into the teaching profession and agree to be fully certified within 2 years. And so that is the emergency certified process. Then it goes, candidates go through background screening, but they have not yet been tested in the course or field or grade that they're teaching. And once they do, then that's part of meeting the criteria required to be certified, alternatively certified even. This, though, is not good for kids in the long run because we know that teachers need training and we need to have confidence that they have expertise in what they're teaching. But we have been in an emergency crisis, and this is a measure that was only utilized 32 times in 2011. Last year, 1,975 people had to be recruited in because there were no applicants that were qualified for the openings. And this year, already in just the first 2 months of the new school year, we have over 1,200 that have had to be granted by the state board. We don't want to do this if we don't have to, obviously. It's intended for an emergency situation, which we are clearly in. But when teachers didn't have the confidence that that pay raise would actually materialize, they didn't sign a contract and they left the profession. And we continue to see that shortage deepen.
And it's not just, do they have the training? Because training's great, but in my profession, and I'm guessing yours, the experience is as or more important. I mean, ultimately, that's what counts is, you know, having actually been in the classroom, actually having taught.
Our kids deserve to have teachers that are well trained and have experience and the resources and tools that they need to provide meaningful instruction so kids can learn. That is not rocket science. We know that's what makes a difference for higher student outcomes. And this is why having competitive pay for teachers was the first step in turning around the teacher shortage and having a more competitive, well-rounded, strong public education for Oklahoma school kids. So this is a first big step, but it is only one of many, and it will not change everything in a day. The funding is something that is in statute. It must be funded. The legislature has that obligation imposed on them from this year forward. But it is something, though, that teachers must have confidence that that's going to really be there. It's going to be there again next year. And right now, we saw that in jeopardy in their minds, particularly with some of the questions that had to be settled by the Supreme Court. And we saw the results of that as many exited Oklahoma classrooms. That'll turn around. And I feel confident that we have good information that some who might have considered retiring aren't going to retire now that that raise is in place, and they have a new incentive to stay with Oklahoma Kids and also see some benefits in their retirement benefits that will, you know, last the rest of their life as well with those benefits. So this is a good thing in stabilizing our education profession.
Right, but only a start, as you said.
Only a start, and you have to remember that it is not, you know, going to solve everything at once. 1 year is never going to be fully what is needed. We have to look at why our teachers leaving, and part of that was pay, but the other is that our teachers need to have autonomy. They need to be able to make decisions in their classrooms. They need to have smaller class size. They want the resources to be able to do what they already know how to do. And for some that are brand new to the profession, they need to better understand classroom management, how to work with children that have diverse learning needs. And those are some of the areas that we're going to focus on in this next year.
So are you familiar with State Question 801?
Is this the question that the governor just, I think, put on the ballot?
She did. Okay. I just saw this, that it's a state question that asks voters whether or not schools can use property tax revenue to cover some operational costs, something which inexplicably, in my mind, has not been allowed in Oklahoma. I'm curious if you've got any thoughts yet on that, on whether you'll support it or if you just need to study it some more. What do you think?
Well, as we definitely want to, now that this is actually going to be on the ballot, examine the language and make certain that we have the opportunity to do that. However, this is something that often has some school districts in favor of it and others that are not in favor. At the time this went through the legislature, we had a neutral position because of that. But we do understand that in many communities, this is a very positive thing. I think that anytime we can give greater flexibility for the way those resources are spent, it is often a very good thing. And I think that Tulsa and the community right here is going to be best positioned to answer if this is something that makes the most sense for each community. And that's really how this will be decided statewide, one community at a time.
Yeah, I think in Tulsa, it's going to be received well. I think some of the more rural communities, some of the smaller districts is where there's going to be a little pushback on that. But I guess we'll see how all of that pans out.
Well, bottom line, when we find ourselves struggling to properly invest in education, that is not good for any student. And I think some of these conversations we have had to really wrestle with because we've not had the proper funding that, you know, our students and the increased enrollment demand. We have been operating in education on the same dollars as in 2008, but with 53,000 more kids and while enduring a severe teacher shortage. There is good news on the horizon, and we know first and foremost we are going to see teachers being really able to not choose between sacrificing the resources in their own families to stay in an Oklahoma classroom. But again, that's just the first step. And we know that no matter what we do moving forward, if we're going to meet the needs of kids, we have to invest in our teachers. And this was a great day, August 1, and our teachers are going to see that in their next paycheck, and it's long overdue.
Oklahoma State School Superintendent Joy Hoffmeister. State Auditor Gary Jones recently concluded an audit of the Oklahoma Department of the VA. The results were not positive. KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Gary Jones about the results and what should happen next.
State Auditor and Inspector Gary Jones, your agency recently conducted an audit of the Oklahoma Department of Veterans Affairs. That report was given to the governor yesterday, I believe.
Yes.
And it is not a pretty picture. Can you kind of bullet point for me some of what your auditors discovered as they were looking at this department?
this is typically what we call a tone at the top issue, where there are concerns of upper management not communicating, making decisions that are not, in our opinion, not in the best interest of the agency and the care of the veterans, which is should be our main focus. And there's an environment of distrust within the agency that, you know, workers are afraid to perform their jobs, afraid to speak out, you know, in regards to things that they have concerns about. And obviously it's something that was brought to our attention. And you know, I invite people to read the report so they get a good understanding of exactly what was going on in this agency.
So a couple of quotes from this audit. Culture of fear and intimidation exists at ODVA. Employees across the state actively fear for their jobs and report experiencing dictatorial and aggressive leadership from the central office. So this is what you're talking about, the top-down sort of toxic work environment that these folks
it is
reporting.
And there's, you know, there were decisions that were questioned, and then individuals were dismissed shortly after they questioned those decisions. And you know, when you have people running long-term care facilities on behalf of our veterans, you know, the mission says that you'll provide the best care possible. And you know, when people questioned anything, they felt like they had somebody that basically, you know, there was retribution against those concerns that they had.
So, in other words, anybody who was even perceived as a potential whistleblower was basically forced out?
Well, and it's mentioned in the audit, even when we went through and started doing our audit and contacted individuals to gather information, they said that they were being monitored. They were getting phone calls saying, you know, we want to know what questions were asked, what you had to say. And they did not feel like they could freely speak with us. In some cases, we had individuals that said that, you know, we actually request that maybe we meet somewhere else so we could speak more freely, or, you know, contacted us afterwards and said, hey, listen, I was less than forthcoming because I was afraid.
So when you and the candidate to replace you, Cindy Bird, were here the other day, we were talking about the different types of audits. And there's, you know, what type of audit was this, and how was it conducted?
This is a performance audit, and it's conducted by which that we go through and we gather information, but we also would send out surveys, anonymous surveys, so we could gather more information from people. And we had some people that, and then the responses we got were amazing. The number of responses we got, the concerns they had about the environment, and people would actually contact us and say that they were afraid to even put it in an email. And so, but that's why you have professionals that go in there and do this. Melissa Capp's team was the one that performed this audit and did a very good job. And it became evident to us real quickly that the employees themselves had major concerns.
So Oklahoma has a lot of veterans, I think well over 300,000 of them, and some 1,300 of them live in facilities that are overseen by the ODVA. All this governed by a 9-member commission. Who appoints these commissioners?
Well, the commissioners are appointed by the governor. There are 6 of them that actually are members of different organizations like the Purple Heart Association, the Veterans of Foreign War, American Legion, and they in turn submit names, 5 names from each organization, and then the governor picks from those. Then there's 3 members at large. But one thing that happened is they went to where the commission used to meet on a monthly basis, and they changed the meetings where they met only once a quarter, every 3 months. And also at the commission meetings, the directors from the individual centers would come, and that way they could converse with the commissioners and keep them informed. The directors were told, don't attend the meetings. We don't want you there at the meetings. And so they were limiting the communications back and forth between the commissioners, which are ultimately the one that manages the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay, I'm a little surprised to hear that. So I have to ask, and maybe there's no way to answer this question, but, I mean, can we ascribe any kind of motive to this? Because it sounds like they're disconnecting from not only from the people that they're supposed to serve, but from the people that are actually on the ground doing the job.
There was a disconnect, and that's, you know, I attended a a meeting in Lawton yesterday at the Veterans Center. They have a monthly residents council where they express concerns, and you could see the concerns that not only the employees had, but the residents of the centers themselves have. And so, you know, when you're a long-term resident of these centers, the people that work there become family, and they're the ones that are aware of what's going on. They're the ones that understand the needs of the residents. And what we found is that the people at the centers, the workers, were very concerned that the decisions that were being made were going to have a negative impact on the care of those residents.
So, again, what is the reason behind it? What is the motive here? I'm confused.
I can't speak to motive other than I think that just different people's management style. I mean, we have the last few directors have been actually generals, retired generals, and it's more of a different type of an atmosphere than it's been in the past. I spoke with one board member that had been on the board previously and had come back on the board just recently, and he said he could tell that there was a decline in the care that's provided to veterans, and he was very concerned about that.
And this is the third audit in recent years of this agency, is that correct?
It is. It's the third one we've done in 5 years. And we had major concerns, each time. But I would tell you that really this is the one we had the most concerns about because of the fact that the lack of communications between the individuals that are providing the care and the central management. And, that in turn can present a lot of problems. And obviously a lot of people have lost their jobs. People are concerned. People leaving in fear of losing their job. That's why I said, as you read through the reports, you'll understand what we're talking about.
And I do plan to read it, but, okay, so third audit in 5 years. The first one was troubling. The second one was troubling. Apparently, nothing got fixed. Now we've got the worst audit of the three, correct? It's perhaps the most...
There were concerns that were addressed, but then these are additional concerns that have been brought up. And there are people that work at the centers, there are people that have loved ones at the centers, legislators, they brought this issue to us, and then ultimately we met with the Attorney General and they requested the audit. And so, this is of grave concern, and these issues need to be addressed and need to be solved.
So I know it's early days. This report was just given to the governor yesterday. Have you or your team had a chance to talk with her and do we have any idea what plan of action will be put in place to solve some of these problems?
We haven't at this time. Like I said, the report was just released yesterday at 1:00. The governor said that she plans on reviewing it, and we'll go from there.
State Auditor Gary Jones. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interviews. This is Oklahoma Perspective. For Cox Media Group, I'm Bert Williams.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.